Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Jim, you and I both cheer for sports teams that have a difficult time beating certain teams in their divisions. For you, as a Jets fan, it's the Patriots. For me, as a Bears fan, most recently, it's been the Packers. And no matter what you do, you just can't beat them. That's frustrating for us. But on a political level, it's got to be the way Democrats are feeling right now, because they just can't beat Scott Walker. They couldn't beat him in 2010. They couldn't beat him in the fight over unions. They couldn't beat him in the recall. They couldn't beat him for reelection. And now they can't beat him when it comes to voter ID laws at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court on Monday leaving intact a new Republican-backed law in Wisconsin that requires voters to present photo identification when they cast ballots. A federal judge blocked the state's voter ID in March 2012, soon after it took effect, and entered a permanent injunction in April, finding the measure would deter or prevent a substantial number of voters who lack photo identification from casting ballots and place an unnecessary burden on the poor and minorities. The 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals blocked the decision and subsequently ruled in October that the law was constitutional. Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld the voter ID in a separate ruling. The Supreme Court put a stay on it late last year because it was right before the midterm elections, but now they've agreed not even to hear the case, and so it gets to stand. And so not only does Scott Walker win again, Jim, but this should provide a pretty good template for other states who want to get their version of voter ID through the legal process.
Your opening assessment about Scott Walker, Greg, is pretty good. I think over at Ace of Spades, when they need to do a graphic of him, they don't use a photo of the, you know, kindly, gentle, easygoing, polite Midwest governor. They do kind of like a Conan the Barbarian type. They saw who is some sort of like ruthless medieval warrior with a giant axe over his shoulder who has been cutting a swath through his enemies. That seems to fit it. And obviously, look, this is a, you know, nice bit of news. It's not really surprising news to us. The idea that you should be required to show photo ID demonstrating that you are the voter who you claim to be at the ballot box is just common sense. But it is good news. Now, look, the Democrats say they're not driven by voter fraud and things like that. But look, you know, they certainly seem to be fighting this thing tooth and nail. So they really seem to see some sort of giant incentive on their part to ensure that you don't need to show ID. I think every state should be taking every step to make sure that if you are who you say you are, we're going to help take care of it. I know in South Carolina, like, look, if you can't afford a photo ID, we'll cover the cost for you. We will do everything we can to get a photo ID into the hands of someone who needs it and deserves it and should have it. But otherwise, you can't vote, or at the very least, you got to do a provisional ballot and make sure you are who you say you are. This is all common sense. It's not surprising. I think what's interesting is that when they reject a challenge, Greg, it's not like they vote, right?
Right.
So conceal, in other words, am I correct in interpreting this, that there's not a single justice who looked at this and said, yeah, we really need to send, you know, to hear this ACLU appeal on this decision?
I think there needs to be a certain number willing to hear it. I don't think it's a majority of them. I think it might be four, but you never find out who votes what when they decide not to hear a case.
Okay. But nonetheless, it's got to be thoroughly discouraging to the ACLU and everybody who doesn't like the Wisconsin laws there. So there you go. Nice little bit of a start. And yes, once again, Walker the Barbarian has slain his foes once again.
Of course, the big one's coming up if, in fact, he becomes the Republican nominee. All right. On to the bad martini, but it's got an interesting twist here as well. This is from The Washington Post. Israel obtained sensitive information about the nuclear talks between Iran and the United States and turned it over to members of Congress, the Wall Street Journal is reporting. The insider details came from confidential briefings from U.S. officials, as well as from informants, diplomatic contacts in Europe, and eavesdropping. Citing current and former officials, the paper said the spying operation was part of a broader campaign by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to penetrate the negotiations and then help build a case against the emerging terms of the deal. Here's the most bizarre part. The Journal, in its Tuesday edition, reported the espionage did not concern the White House as much as Israel's sharing of inside information with U.S. lawmakers and others to drain support for a possible deal with Iran to rein in Tehran's nuclear program in exchange for the easing of international sanctions. So, Jim, apparently the only way we can really find out what's going on here and get a straight deal is from Israeli intelligence, but the administration's more upset that Congress knows what's going on than the fact that spying is going on in these talks.
Like somebody else had said on Twitter earlier today, I had to read the story twice to make sure I really understood what the administration was complaining about. Look, the Israelis spy on everybody, all right? And it's very hard to begrudge anyone that because, look, it's a dangerous world, and they got to keep their eyes on, you know, threats from everywhere. Oh, by the way, this is the same, you know, the administration is complaining that Israel is spying on it. The Iran negotiations, this is the same administration and NSA that is spying on you, American. All right, so it's only a problem when other people do it, not when they do it. But secondly, think about this from the point of view of you know, members of Congress. They effectively need the Mossad to tell them what the Obama administration is giving away in negotiations with Iran. That is how screwed up our situation, relationship between Congress and the presidency has gotten. And there's a very simple, easy way to shut this down and resolve this. If you're the administration, keep Congress informed. It might even see there's something in the Constitution about checks and balances, and the idea of, you know, that the president is not a dictator. He does not make all the decisions himself. Yes, some of these things are going to be classified. Yes, some of these things are going to be sensitive. If you're a Democratic president or Secretary of State, and you can't work with that, you know, lunatic, fire-breathing Bob Corker of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker is probably one of the most even-keeled guys. Well, yeah, he didn't sign that letter about with the 47 senators, right? I think Bob Corker has been bending over backwards to try to be an honest broker, a reasonable negotiator, to be somebody who the administration can talk to on Capitol Hill, and they don't talk to him because ultimately this administration doesn't believe that there's a role for Congress either in domestic policy or foreign policy. We can go in either direction than that. Apparently now you don't get FEMA funds if you don't toe the administration's line on climate change and global warming. Basically, this is just one more example of this. And what's kind of fascinating is the indignation of the Obama administration of how dare they talk to Israelis about what's going on in these negotiations. Who do they think they are? Members of the American government or something?
Amazing. Just amazing. All right. On to the crazy martini now, Jim. And we talked about this a couple of different times, I believe, late last year. Last fall, there was an article that came out in Rolling Stone talking about the rape culture on campus. It specifically told this story of a gang rape at the University of Virginia involving a girl under the pseudonym of Jackie. And it led to this whole firestorm of criticism of permissive rape culture at different schools. The fraternity system was indicted, and eventually the Washington Post and others kind of dug into the different details of the story, found out there wasn't even a party the night of the alleged rape, and then the story just got peeled back as not true piece by piece by piece. Yesterday, the Charlottesville Police Department, that's where the University of Virginia is located, essentially said there's no evidence to suggest that a rape ever happened, that Jackie was not cooperative at all with police. She did not come to them immediately after this alleged incident happened, and as far as they can tell, the case is essentially over because there's no evidence that any criminal activity happened. And there was the line in there that many on the left are going with, that just because there's no evidence doesn't mean something didn't happen that was horrible. But after everything that the school and different fraternities have been raked over the coals for, it appears that none of this was true. At least there's no evidence, not a shred, to suggest that it actually happened.
Well, I said this should be the crazy martini of the day. The fact that they weren't able to find evidence to support the Rolling Stone story isn't really shocking. We kind of figured that obviously there were people who came forward who said, actually, what I told the reporter didn't match what came up in the story, and that actually this doesn't mesh with what I had told, you know, what I remember that night, and things like that. The details were so vivid, and the idea that this act described in the article would somehow be kept hidden forever. What I found crazy about it is, look, the Charlottesville Police Department has literally spent months investigating this. They have run down every conceivable lead or possibility of gathering evidence, and they did not find a shred of evidence. We don't know what happened to that woman that night, but it did not happen as it was described in that article. And what's more, think about it, we really don't have any evidence that a crime was committed. Right? Now, it doesn't mean that she didn't go through something traumatic. We don't know. We don't have perfect clairvoyance of what happened that night, but that ultimately... So if you're the isn't filing a false police report a crime? I guess the idea is that, well, she didn't file a police report, so it's not really, there's no crime committed there. Filing a police report is a crime because it wastes police resources, it wastes the police time. The police have now had to spend oodles of time investigating this allegation that we all kind of figured was kind of nonsensical, or at least didn't add up from early on. And they've had to spend all that time doing that instead of, say, dealing with other crimes. And, oh, by the way, that area of Virginia did have a serial killer stalking people up until fairly recently. So there are other crimes that require police attention in that area. What I'm kind of struck by is that, you know, maybe this woman did go through something traumatic, and if that's the case, you hope she gets the care she needs. But I think we're entitled to a little bit of anger here, that basically she has told a false tale. She has told a tale that does not have evidence to support it. And as a result of that, you know, the fraternities on campus were banned, and they shut down for an entire semester and all that stuff. And the only thing that a lot of people want to talk about is like, well, maybe this case wasn't true, but the culture there. But let's not talk about what actually happened here. Let's go talk to these other things. A false accusation is, if not a crime, if you don't file the police report, it is morally wrong. And the idea that somehow this has served some greater truth or raised awareness or something like that, no, you don't raise awareness by making false accusations. So what I find really kind of crazy, and not only this is the crazy martini today, Greg, is that the lack of anger over that false accusation by the university culture, by everybody in authority and things like that, really does kind of seem like we have elevated the notion of sympathy, or maybe even this preening sympathy, over the value of truth. And I think that can only lead to worse things in the future.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks would agree with that. On that sobering note, we'll call it for the day. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.